Lily has had a career as an artist all her adult life, and however, she has some interesting stories of growing up in Dunbar, so please, Laurie, can we start with that? You told me about growing up in the house at the corner of 18th and Dunbar. Is that the first house that you remember?
Yeah, some of my earliest memories are there, for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And your parents' names were?
Donald Latremoil and Frances Latremoil. Her maiden name was Sajensky.
How would you spell that?
Oh, that's quite difficult. It's S-C-Z-E-N-S-K-I.
Oh,
yeah, I have to check that.
Okay.
It's quite a toughie. Yeah, okay. Learning Latremoil was hard enough, you know, but I learned a little rhyme. I was like, Latremoille. I learned that when I was little and rehearsed it because it was always a challenge just spelling my own last name.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yes, I had one of those names too before I got the easy name of Chambers. So, anyway, that house, can you remember the address while you're at it?
I didn't remember off the top of my head, but I have a photo of it, and I think it's written in the photo.
Really?
Yeah. It was 3611 West 18th.
3611 West 18th. Yeah. Okay, so that house was on the north side of 18th.
Yes.
Right at the corner of Dunbar.
Yes.
And in the year 2001, people know that house as having a store built on the front of it, and there was a Chinese grocery market there for quite a number of years, and now closed, right?
Yes, yes.
But at the time you were living there, that was not built.
No, that was just our front yard.
That was your front yard.
I used to sit there with my little swimming pool, and one of my other early memories when I was thinking back to that house is the whole corner there as well. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I played around the house, and one of my little artistic excursions is I got some chalk pastels for Christmas, and me and my friend Linda Lynch did murals all over the sidewalk, all the way around the corner.
Oh, my goodness.
And caused quite a splash with my mom.
Oh.
Yeah.
She didn't think you should have done that.
Yeah, so I got in trouble with that. But obviously that artistic impetuism was there at an early age.
Sure, you were always going to be an artist. Can you remember what was across the road on the corner of 18th? Not across Dunbar, but...
Yeah, there
was
a Safeway. And we used to, of course, go shopping there all the time.
I guess as the interviewer, I will just say for the record that that house was moved to where you lived in it in order for the Safeway company to build where they did. And it's now the liquor store with the entrance inside the little mini mall.
Yeah.
But, excuse me, you seem to have a happy life with friends, and particularly one friend on that corner.
Yeah, Linda Lynch.
Yeah.
Yeah, she lived up on Dunbar a couple of blocks up.
Uh-huh.
The Lynches lived there for a long time, and she had about five sisters.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were there for a long time, and Linda went to Immaculate Conception School with me. So we were friends in the neighborhood before school, and then we went to school together.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you had a friend across Dunbar as well, whose grandmother you said was a...
Yeah, that was Monica Campbell was her name, my friend, and her nanny, and I just remember her name is Nanny, but I can find out her proper name for you. Had a hair shop there in the house, and I used to play with Monica, and Nanny always had clients coming in and doing their hair. She had a full salon in the house.
I see, and that house is no longer there, right? That
was I can't remember quite when it was torn down, but quite a while it's been a vacant lot there.
Right, with a sign on it.
There's like a big commercial sign.
A big commercial sign,
right. And I always wondered, you know, why they tore down Nanny's house and just left a blank lot. I don't know what happened.
No. Are you still in touch with that friend?
Yeah, I know Monica. She lives up in Kitimat.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Yeah,
so we've kept in touch.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And Nanny's passed away now.
Mm-hmm.
But I can definitely find out her name and the name of the shop. the proper name.
Yeah. Well, if we don't have it, it would be interesting to have it, actually. And just like, what year would that be? You were born in what year?
1963. Right. And Monica and I were friends from the time we were about 3 or 4. So we're remembering back to at least 1966.
Right.
And then I'm just trying to think how long Nanny was there. Because Monica's mom married, and Monica moved away up north, but Nanny was still there. And then sometimes she'd come and visit Nanny, and I'd go and visit her. But I think that ranges up to about 1975.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know why I can't quite remember when the house went down, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it would have been fairly disturbing.
Yeah,
to see your friends.
Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah, it was a nice place. Yeah.
So you went from grade 1 to grade
3.
3 at the convent?
Yes. Well, no, the Immaculate Conception.
At Immaculate Conception. And then where did you go?
I went to Trafalgar.
Oh. It's quite a distance. Did you move?
We moved to 25th and Blenheim.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess I would have had a choice to go to...
You could have gone to Kitchener.
Yeah, but I didn't. I went to Trafalgar. Mm-hmm. Wait a second. Excuse me. We moved to 21st and McDonald.
Oh,
And I started in grade 4 at Trafalgar, and then we moved up to 25th and Blenheim, and I wanted to stay at Trafalgar because I had my friends there.
You had
there.
Friends.
Yeah.
And then when you went to high school?
I went to Prince of Wales.
I see. And then when did you go to the convent then?
I went to the convent in grade 10, so that would have been 78, 79. I was there only for 1 year.
Ah.
I would have stayed, you know, for 11 and 12, but they closed down.
Right. So did you go back to...
Yeah, I went back to PW,
as it were. Yeah. Now, you showed me, we will get to your art, which you definitely made your life.
Mm-hmm.
You showed me a certificate that you got in your year at the Convent of the Sacred Heart, and says that Laurie Ann has, class grade 10, has received the prize for art June 11th, 1979.
Yeah.
And so this was your first recognition as an artist?
It was, I was so proud of it. And I still am.
Well, you should be. I think that's just lovely.
Yeah.
And there was a notable teacher there, since you mentioned your convent life, and it was just 1 year for you that this teacher... You mentioned being a great help to you, and she was Mrs. Lorraine Vazo, and that's VEZAU.
Right.
And she was the director of instruction for several years until the convent did close, and then finished her career at Crofton House teaching history. You've given me some very strong impressions of this very elegant, knowledgeable teacher. So
She was very memorable.
Yeah,
she was, of course, the head of the convent, and as I said to you, you got the feeling she was the prime minister of the school, and she was very, very well spoken, very elegant, very well dressed, and very, very bright. And I had the luxury of having her as a history teacher. And I think she might have taught us some French as well. I'm not positive, but I think she may have. And, you know, she had this incredible prominence about her. But at one time I was having some troubles at home, and I went to her. I had missed a test. And I was so upset, and I suppose I was a bit, you know, in awe of her as well. And she was so sweet and considerate of my situation, and you know, treated me like a mother. I mean, she was so nice.
Uh-huh.
And she was wonderful.
Yeah, I'm glad to have this word about her, because she did pass away on September the 11th 2001 is here. And so it's nice to have a reminiscence about her, because I think people were affected by her. And she was extremely...
Oh, she was so bright. I just remember her teaching us things, you know, to do with history and to do with law and free trade. And she knew Canadian history so well and so elaborately. And I think even at the time, I couldn't appreciate it. But as I got older and learned more about my own country, I'd think back and I'd think, yeah, she taught us that, you know. And I, you know, so she's just sort of grown in my mind over the years.
Yeah. That's very nice to know. So thank you for giving us that little bit of history about somebody outstanding.
Yeah, she's special.
Yeah. Very special. So, however, your family got you to the convent, and...
We were at that time living right across the street from the convent.
Oh, I see.
So we moved around quite a bit in the Dunbar area.
I see.
My mom, sometimes for income, she would buy a house and fix it up and remodel it and resell it, and we'd move on.
And your mother had a career?
That's what she did for extra money. Mm-hmm. I guess you'd call that interior decorating and, you know, remodeling a home.
I see.
And in that way, it enabled her to stay home and look after us and still kind of produce an income.
Very good. And so we were, in fact, living in the 3800 block across of 29th, across from the convent. And and then did you go back down to PW?
Yeah, I did.
I should ask you, were you a sizable family?
There was myself, and I have an older brother and sister who both went to Lord Byng. In fact, my father was educated at Lord Byng as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you did mention Lorraine Vaso possibly teaching you some French. Your family name is a French name, so was French spoken in your home at all?
No, it wasn't. No, my father was born here, and his father died at a young age, so he was the French element in the family. My grandmother was from Birmingham, England.
Oh.
So, you know, my father spoke English.
And I see.
Yeah. So the only French I got was at school, but I always loved it and always took right to it.
So it was just an interesting thing, because to keep a family language is sometimes quite difficult too.
And
your father died when you were fairly young.
Yeah, when I was 12.
So your mother was really in a position where she needed to do something to assist the family.
When my father died, he wasn't well for a number of years, so even at that time when we were at 18th and Dunbar, he wasn't very well.
So
she was sort of running some. Yeah, she was running things.
So let's go back to the art, because it's mentioned that you got this certificate in 1979. So did you sort of always know that you were going to be an artist, or that that was a sort of a thing that you could be, compelled to draw things and do things?
You know, I just always liked doing it, you know, and I always loved drawing, and I was sort of a quiet person, and even in my living room, I used to take my different toys, my Tinker toys, or anything that I had, and I'd sort of create, like, it was almost like an installation in the living room. I'll show you a picture of it, actually. And so that's, I was just always doing art in some way when I was little, but I never sort of thought of myself as an artist.
Did your brother
it's just
and sister
what I did.
Do that too?
My sister, I remember she used to draw cartoons sometimes. She was 15 years older than me, so
there's
quite. But I remember her drawing Scampi and Peanuts, and she could copy it perfectly. And not my brother, but my brother, he was more interested in radio and poetry and writing.
Radio. Now, did he become well known as a radio figure? What was his name?
His name was Don Latremoil as well.
There was a Fred who had that.
He's my cousin.
Oh, Fred is your cousin.
Yeah, that's my
dad. He cut the name short in order to
That's right.
The rest of us could pronounce.
Yeah, yeah. No, he, my dad's oldest brother, Bruce, is Fred's father.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there is a connection.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And my brother, he did a little bit of radio, I guess it would have been in about the mid-70s, and then he got out of doing it. He wasn't well, and it was a lot of pressure for him, and
he
decided to work for the city, and sort of also always living under the shadow of Fred, because Fred was famous by then,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah. It was better to have a separate life of his own.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it just wasn't suitable for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your family definitely has sort of artistic tendencies, but you're the one that has carried it on.
Yeah,
so
my father liked writing poetry as well.
And poetry. And he encouraged you with your art?
Yeah, every time, you know, I draw something, he'd pin it up on the fridge. And it was kind of the apple of his eye. So I just, you know, I thrived on that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And the encouragement was there. Did you go to art school after high school?
No, I didn't. I enjoyed my high school art, though, and I had a really good, a couple of really good teachers there as well.
Who were they?
I had Mr. Carter, and I'm just trying to think of the last one. I had a number of them, but they were really good teachers and gave me lots of inspiration and also entered some of my work in some sort of all over BC high school contests, and I won some awards, and that encouraged me a
bit. That encouraged you, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't go to art school, and did you go out and sort of do the usual thing and get a job after?
Well,
after
I actually left home when I was 16.
Did you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was my mother remarried, and I didn't get on well with my stepdad, and there was some problems there.
Uh-huh.
And so I left home, and I was working at Budget Rent-A-Car while I was going to high school, finishing high school.
Oh, yeah.
And after being at Budget for a couple of years, summers and stuff, I thought, well, I'd really like to do something that I enjoy. And I went to an art show downtown at a gallery called E equals MC squared, and it was kind of a funky artist-run gallery.
Yeah.
And I went to the show, and I thought, and I looked at the show, and I thought, I want to do this, and I thought, I can do this.
Yeah.
I know I can do this. And I'm drawing out a bit. So basically, I just started working on my own, and I took, at Emily Carr, I took a night school course, drawing from the model, and I used to get friends to pose for me, and I did that quite a bit, and then I just got tired of asking people to pose for me, so I just started drawing from my imagination. And in 1984, next to the gallery E equals MC squared was another artist-run gallery on Homer and Pender. And I went in there and I asked about doing a show, and I think it was Myros Burian was the artist, or Buriak, that was showing there at the time. He said, well, actually, we just rented from the lady at the bookstore and we're closing down, so you can ask her if you want to rent it for like a month or whatever. So I went in and I was able to rent it for $100 for 2 weeks.
Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful.
So I just, you know, I could have it, and that was 2 weeks from the time, so I had 2 weeks to go home and work, and get enough stuff ready, and I did my first show and made my own invitation, and invited all my friends and relatives and advertised it, and, you know, looking back on it now, it was kind of bold, and when I think of the work, it was quite naive and very beginner for me, but as a result of that show, I got asked to be into some group shows at different galleries and stuff. And
did you sell anything from that first
show? I did. I sold two pieces, and one to a very good collector, actually.
Oh.
Ivo Burian. So that was a real exciting thing that he'd bought something of mine.
So, and he heard about it from your advertising or through a friend?
Well, next door, there was another gallery called E equals MC squared, and Joe Average, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was having a show the same night.
Oh,
so we opened the same night, so we shared clients.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think he might have been at Joe's show and just wandered over.
I see.
Yeah.
3 and 6.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so.
Yeah. And then since then, so did that encourage you to quit your job?
Yes, in
right
fact,
away,
in
almost?
Fact, I had quit my job before.
Oh.
I had quit about 6 months before and was doing my work. And, you know, I got a start there, and I did a couple of more group show things that year. And, you know, starting to get low on money, it was getting
yeah.
a bit scary. And then I got picked up by the Heffel Gallery, an art dealer by the name of Sonia de Grand Maison, saw my work at a BC artist show. Do you know
really?
Her?
Really, yes.
You do? She saw it, and she...
Is that Sonia Senior, the older lady, or...?
Sonia must be about 55.
Yeah, the daughter.
The daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had her first gallery in Calgary when she was 23.
Oh.
This Sonia, and her brother is a painter, a famous painter, and her father was a famous painter.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, so Sonia showed my work to the Heffel Gallery, and I was taken on by the Kenneth Heffel Gallery when I was just 20, which was a
nice.
Real lucky break. I'm in this gallery, and they, you know, they have Emily Carr and Group of Seven, and all these people. I mean, it was really,
yeah.
it was a real coup.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I did my first show with them. My first group show was 1986, and then my first solo show in 1987, which is what is in right here.
And was that at Heffel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, you've never looked back.
Yeah, I was just, when I look back on it, I just think I was so lucky. I just kind of struck out, and people picked me up,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well,
amazing.
You were very bold, and you have a very distinctive style, and it obviously strikes a chord with people. Now, your work has been described as surrealist, and you mentioned surrealist yourself. Have you... are you influenced by anything other than your own imagination, or was there a mentor? Or
well, definitely, you know, throughout my career as an artist, I've always looked at, you know, I find an art book about a discovering artist, and you know,
mm-hmm.
just look through all the images
mm-hmm.
and feed off the images.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1986, I came in contact with the Melmoth Group, which is also known as the West Coast Surrealist Group.
Mm-hmm.
Which Michael Bullock and Ladislav Guderna were the founding members.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a lot of surrealist shows, you know, sort of all over the lower mainland here together. And I learned a lot about surrealism
mm-hmm.
from them, you know,
yeah.
besides the classics that, you know, like Salvador Dali
right.
and Frida Kahlo.
And you had known about them as you were starting to develop your own style,
yeah.
or did that come
yeah,
later?
No, I did here and there, but not really in much depth,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I, you know, I do work and I do a show and somebody'd say, oh, that reminds me of, you know, Botero, or your work reminds me of M.C. Escher, so I, you know, run to the library, get a book, look it up, and
oh, yeah.
see what they were talking about,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
so I've had a lot of, you know, different comparisons, or
mm-hmm.
people will say Rousseau or Picasso or Goya or all different things.
That's all different things.
Yeah.
Now, your main medium is pastel on paper, right? And
yeah, well, it's actually
the
majority of it is charcoal.
And charcoal.
And pastel is the
yeah.
color. So charcoal for the blacks and whites.
Yeah. And did it take you a while to come around to that? Or, I mean, it seems to me you started with the chalk on the side of
that's right.
And
I
you
mean,
never left it?
That's right. I guess, you know, it's funny, I, you know, thinking back to it, but when I was doing, when I had taken that course drawing from the model and I was
mm-hmm.
getting, you know, people to pose for me, at first you start with, you know, Conte or lead or whatever, and I kept finding that it was never black enough.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I always, you know, the lead was too shiny, and
yeah.
I could never get it, you know, even if I had 8B or 10B or
yeah.
whatever. And, you know, I was down at Opus, and I saw these Holbein carbon chalks, and
yeah.
they were so, so black and so rich, and I started drawing with that, and it was no looking back. And, you know, I could get so much texture out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I, you know,
true.
I just kind of stumbled in. I kind of had a passion for the black and the boldness and
mm-hmm.
the delineation, and that
yeah.
was where I found it.
Yeah, you do have like borders and outlines on your many interlocking figures, but black is a very strong element of of everything with white and very bold colors showing in them. So it's a very distinctive style. I think I'm repeating myself at this point. And so at this stage in your life, you're established, really.
Yeah, well, the next real big break after the Heffel came as a result of Sonia de Grand Maison as well, and she came to me and she said, you know, if you want to show out of town, just let me know, you know, if you feel, you know, and I said, well, you know, I'll do my first few shows here, and, you know, because it was suddenly I had to have, you know, 30 pieces for a show, and it was, you know, a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of years, I thought, well, yeah, I could see trying to show out of town. And she took my work to the Seattle Art Fair. Mm-hmm. And there was a dealer there, Marianne Partlow from Olympia, and another one from Ogden Gallery in Portland. And they saw my work, and the guy from Portland just went crazy.
Oh.
He was, you know, he said, Sonia, I can't believe she's so young and she's doing stuff like this.
Oh,
and
isn't that nice? Yeah.
Took on my work, and then phoned up Sonia, who was acting as my agent mm-hmm. for the stage, and said, you know, basically, I don't want her to be doing anything else but her artwork. And, mm-hmm. you know, tell me how much she needs a month to live, and I'll buy it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was excellent.
So that set me up with a solid income, yeah. and that all happened very quickly. That was, you know, the beginning of 1988. So mm-hmm. it was, you know, from the time I started, it all sort of moved very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you got yourself into the right thing for you, right?
Yeah, and it just, you know, the right people, you know, almost like angels were there ready to sort of say, okay, next step, do this, next mm-hmm. step, do that. And it's been wonderful. He's made, like, all these beautiful catalogs of my work. My first show with him, he did that. I was astonished because...
Now when you say him, who is this?
His name is Bob Cox. And he runs the Ogden Gallery, and I remember...
How do you spell that?
A-U-G-E-N
okay.
Gallery.
In where?
Portland, Oregon. It's 817 Southwest 2nd in Portland. Yeah. And, you know, my first couple of shows with the Heffel, it was always kind of an argument, you know, well, would they do a color invitation? Because, you know, my pieces were black and white, but they had one color. And, of course, even though it was just one color, I still wanted the whole invite to be in color. And it was always, you know, and they finally, you know, capitulated and say, yeah, we'll print that, you know, that way. But I go down to my first show in Portland, and he's printed a 16-page catalog of my work, and I was just astonished.
Yeah, it seems that the resources and attitude are very, very different, right?
Yeah. And
well, this is a very handsome catalog.
Yeah, and he just, you know, did them year after year, and color ones, and just beautiful.
That's lovely.
You know, which you probably, I mean, galleries here, I mean, it's just so totally unusual for anybody, you know, unless you're Alex Colville or Jack Shadbolt or something.
Yes.
You know, and I was like, you know, 23, 24, and he was making these things for me.
Yes, but you were showing something that was...
Yeah, well, and I think he was also willing to really market it and be energetic, and he went to the San Francisco Art Fair and the LA Art Fair and, you know, has gotten me shows in Seattle and San Francisco and Florida and Atlanta, and, you know, he really works for you, you know, which is good.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, galleries like the Heffel, like, I really liked Mr. Heffel, and he died in 1988. And the gallery changed considerably when his sons took it over.
Oh,
that was Ken Heffel.
Mm-hmm.
But you did get the feeling there that, you know, you're doing shows and they're selling the work, but they weren't really doing anything to get the work out of Vancouver or to promote you any further, kind of thing.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a real blessing because my living's been made off of that gallery in Portland and that dealer, really.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
when did you come to this house on Mackenzie Street, which is like a secret hideaway almost because it's behind some stores?
That was November of 88.
Oh, I've been here a long time.
Yeah. So almost all of this work has been created right in this house, in this area. And I, every day I'm up in the endowment lands walking my dog and, you know, up in Dunbar and, you know, walking by Immaculate and the convent and all the places that I grew up in, you know, 18th and Dunbar. It's, you know, I said my husband's from England, and I said, I always feel like it's such a pleasure that I've lived here. It's almost like it's sort of timeless because I keep walking down these streets, and I was walking there when I was 5 and 6, and
right.
Now I'm 38, and
yeah.
All these things have happened, but it's still a lot the same. It's kind of like being in watching a movie or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. When did you meet your husband?
1991.
91.
Yeah, he was visiting from England.
Uh-huh. And he did tell me that that was it. He never really went back.
Yeah, yeah. No.
So you showed me your studio, which in another life for this house would have been a bedroom, I would think, up
yes.
on the main floor, and very good windows and enough space for your very large concepts. And Angus has his studio in the basement because he's sort of into the construction type of stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So you've been here
10 years
together.
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is, you've got a wonderful location and sort of a wonderful way of working. Do you ever make pieces that, like, you make one part and he makes the other, or is your work quite separate?
It is quite separate, but I think we influence each other a little bit, mm-hmm. and we've done some shows together. We've done our Artist and our Mitch shows, and we've done one down in Portland and one over in Gibson's at the art gallery there.
Mm-hmm.
And we called our show over there Opposites Attract.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of like, because people tend to think of my work as kind of having like almost a dreamy kind of feel to it. And sort of more maybe the brighter side of psychology in that way. And then people will look at his work and they'll think it's the darker, more nightmarish, more frightening side.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, both works are figurative.
Yes.
Both works are bold. A lot of his work is kind of monochromatic like mine, almost black and white.
Uh-huh.
And then sometimes he introduces a color in a very bright way. So I see all these, there is something, and I know that there's certain things that he does that, you know, different textures, certain that kind of influences things that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think we should try that one day to make something together.
Yeah.
I've thought of that because I think that would be fun.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
It really would.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Is there anything else that I should be asking you about? You've lived in Dunbar for a long time,
yeah.
So I'm just going to go to one of our sheets that has different subjects that different people can cover, and I'm wondering if you'd like to see if there's anything there, if you've got any thoughts on the environment or changes that you've seen in Dunbar that
yeah.
either please you or disturb you, whichever.
Yeah, well, I guess because I've spent most of my life here, almost all of my life, when I think about disturbing changes, I think one of the worst ones was when we saw a real sort of surge of development in the whole
mm-hmm.
area, and I saw a lot of beautiful old houses being torn down and sort
mm-hmm.
of what I'd call pink boxes being put back up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a musician as well, and I have a CD, and I wrote a song called Bulldozing Machine, which is actually about it. You know, that was disturbing for me. On the other hand, Angus being a sculptor who uses found objects and reuses things.
Mm-hmm.
We went to as many demo sales and, you know, saved as much in terms of interesting old objects and fixtures as we could. And he's used some of it in his artwork, so I feel at least he's resurrected some
yeah.
of that history in a, you know, in a totally different way.
Yeah.
But I found that disturbing, and it seems to have slowed down, and I hope I don't see another period like that
mm-hmm.
in the neighborhood. It
mm-hmm.
seems that people are getting a little more concerned about heritage and neighborhood. You know, just
mm-hmm.
if you're going to build a new house, make it fit into the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I love things like the convent, the architecture. There's some
mm-hmm.
beautiful. I mean, I think that's a stunning building. I'm just distraught about the way St. George's destroyed the forest land and just leveled it, because there was this beautiful path that used to go through the forest there.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
it was so
where the senior school is. Yeah.
And that was the convent, right? That the Saint.
Oh, you're talking about on the convent grounds.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
and they destroyed all behind
yeah.
there. It was so beautiful. It was, and they had an orchard, and they just flattened it all. But that, I guess, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to live the rest of my life in Dunbar. I don't know if I'll ever be able to afford a house. I rent the house that I live in. And I've just been lucky that the rent is extremely affordable. It's probably half of what it could be. I hope someday I get to buy a house in Dunbar and stay in Dunbar. And like I said, I'd live the rest of my life here.
Would you buy this one if you had the chance?
Oh, in a flash. Uh-huh. But it's part of three lots, and it includes all the stores. So I'd have to buy all the stores and the house, which would be an absolute fortune. So yeah. I don't think that'll happen, but who knows? Maybe they'd subdivide it. But apparently the house is on the dividing line of three lots.
Oh, really? Oh. Yeah. Well, they used to do that in the old days, like buy two or three lots and have enough garden space around them.
Yeah.
Now it's all gone.
Yeah.
The stores. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I hope that we can maintain things and keep it as it is. I love the endowment lands, as I have said.
Yes.
Keep it an off-leash park that everybody can enjoy. I'm seeing here. Were you helped or influenced by people in the community? Well, we had mentioned Mrs. Vaso. Michael Bullock is an artist that lives in the community.
Oh, right. And he told me in no uncertain terms I had to come and see you.
Yeah, and I've done some
books. How did you get to meet him?
The Surrealist Group, yeah. Mm-hmm. He came here in 68, and he founded it with Ladislav Guderna. So that's how I actually met Michael. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, as artists do, because you have a lifestyle where you're working for yourself and your friends become the people who have that same lifestyle. So we go shopping together and walk the dogs, and he's a really great friend and a real inspiration. I've done a number of book covers for him.
Yes, he's given me some.
So that's definitely, I'm just trying to think of other people.
He is sort of an age to be like a grandfather figure.
He's so lively and so perky. I mean, Michael's like a 30-year-old trapped in an 83-year-old body. You know, he's so up to date and hip on everything. But he is of that age, but he seems just like a friend. He's, you know, he's timeless that way.
Yeah, I
think that's like one of the magics of art. Yeah. You know, people will say, you know, even to me, they'll say, oh, you look really young for your age or whatever. And I go, well, you know, it's doing art.
Yeah.
It's like a magic meditation, you know, doing art and walking in the endowment lands, and it keeps you young and bright and sharp.
Yeah.
You know, so that's one of the bonuses of doing art. I hoped that traffic doesn't get overwhelming. Like around the convent, it's just terrible now.
Yeah.
And I hope they don't develop that more, because it's just ridiculous. You can't even get near Michael's place sometimes with the traffic.
Yeah, he's quite disturbed about it, needless to say.
Famous and interesting people. I am positive that I'm not even as aware as I should be of all the people in the neighborhood, like you were telling me, and I know from artists in our midst that there's a lot of great artists and musicians, and it's a cultural hotbed here.
Yes.
And I told you before, when I had visited places like Montreal and Toronto and sort of imagining them to be kind of like the art capitals of Canada, and going to, you know, galleries and studios and stuff and really thinking, you know what, this is the art capital of Canada, Vancouver. There are so many great artists.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Canadians or Vancouverites probably even have an inkling of appreciation for what they have here in terms of culture, and that culture is a big commodity and something that we should think of in an important way that tends to get ignored, you know, and that's something we should be marketing our culture, not just our trees and our resources.
Thank you. Yes, I agree with you.
And everybody who comes here, and you know, I introduce them to art, and they're like, my God, this is, there's so many artists here. And I say, I know, and I think it's, you know, it's a beautiful place to live, and it's kind of got, I think there's something really creative in the atmosphere here, and it's a cultural hotbed that's sort of unknown, and maybe will come to be known, but quite honestly, as an artist that's been working for, 18 years or something, which isn't a long time in the grand spectrum of things, but long enough to realize that Canada doesn't appreciate its artists. And I remember when I was a little girl and Joni Mitchell was first coming out in the early 70s, and hearing her and Neil Young and different people complaining about being completely ignored by Canada. And unfortunately, that's what happens a lot of time to artists in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I've made my living and my support mostly from the States. Mm-hmm. I've done work here and shows, and there are collectors here, but it wouldn't support me. No. You know, and I'd love to see people start to become more culturally aware of what they have and to support it and nurture mm-hmm. it and become aware of it. And that includes me. I have to become more aware of what's around me because, mm-hmm. as you said, there's a lot I don't even know.
Well, I think it's in the nature of being an artist that you spend some, I won't call it lonely hours, but alone hours at any rate, just to apply your profession.
That's right. It isolates you to
yes.
a certain extent
yes.
when you're working. Yeah, that's the sort of meditative quality of it, I think.
Yeah.
And I love listening to the CBC, and you know, Canada is just an amazing place culturally, and I hope
right.
that people start opening up their eyes and appreciating it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful punchline
to
end on.